Topic number 3. 1 week from today will be Christmas 1976. On that day, most Americans will be celebrating the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ by giving gifts to one another. The joy of giving is something most everyone understands to a greater or lesser extent. When presents are opened on Christmas Day, for example, parents of small children usually get their greatest fun out of watching their children open presents, not from opening their own gifts. In the same vein, people usually feel good about it when they give a portion of what they have to help others or to support a worthy cause. This is the foundation of what is known as charity. But unfortunately, there are always a very few among us who are motivated not by a spirit of sharing, but by runaway greed. Their only pleasure in life comes from amassing more and more of this world's wealth for their own coffers, and extending their power to control the wealth of others as well. Ultimately, those who are motivated this way reach the point where they have so much wealth and so much power that it is no longer enough just to add to it just still further. The only thing left in life for those who have acquired wealth and power through greed is to use that power and that wealth to play with the lives and destinies of people. In short, they try to play God. You may ask, why would the Soviet Union go to war? Would the super wealth of America want to create a dictatorship here with themselves in control? You might as well ask, why does the mountain climber want to climb the highest mountain? The common answer is because it's there. Just like the United States, the richest country in the world is there. What a prize. Early in this century, a systematic long-range program was begun by a small group of immensely powerful people. The goal of this program was to acquire ever greater control over American society. This was to lead ultimately to America's merging into a one-world government with themselves and their heirs in control. The method by which this would be accomplished was the dismantling of the basic structure of American society and its reconstruction in the image desired by those who had decided to play God. And to carry out this long-range program, powerful tax-free foundations were established and given the halo of philanthropy. They were explained to the public as simply a special means the wealthy had devised for giving to the public at large. Each foundation was thus given the image of an institutional Santa Claus. Instead of questioning what they did, the American people was led to accept their activities in the confident belief that they were just showering wonderful gifts on our society day in and day out. This is the picture that is still accepted as the truth by most Americans. They believe it just as fervently as millions of small children believe in Santa Claus. The raw truth about this network of foundations may therefore sound unbelievable, just as it sounds unbelievable to a small child if he is told there is no Santa Claus. For months now, I've been referring to the role that has been played by these foundations in undermining American society and placing us in the extreme peril we now face. Now I have been given permission to reveal one of my primary sources of information about these foundations, and to repeat for you his own words about them. He is my friend, Mr. Norman Dodd. Mr. Dodd was director of research of the Special Committee of the United States House of Representatives to investigate tax-exempt foundations in 1953 and 1954. The late Congressman Carol Reese of Tennessee was chairman of this very important committee. Recently, Mr. Dodd gave a rare speech here in Washington, D.C., and he has given permission to repeat it here for you. I will now be quoting him. This is not going to be a speech. This is a sharing of ideas born of experience. And I'd like to begin by qualifying myself in your minds. I am a product of a strange type of education and schooling. The education of which I am a product featured the importance of the question, why? And then went on to try to instill in us the importance of the question, plus our responsibility as individuals to find the answers. I happen to have taken this education and schooling seriously, and I have lived accordingly. In this schooling to which I was subjected, great stress was laid upon the history of this country to illustrate the feature I have just mentioned. As a result, I participated in and was witness to something in the nature of a discovery, which was that in the 200 years of our history, many more truths made themselves self-evident than motivated our founding fathers. One of these truths bear heavily upon the experiences that I shall recite to you. The truth, were it to be put in words, would read something like this. I'll repeat it slowly because it is quite significant and deserving of considerable thought. The condition or state of the members of any nation at any given time reflects the use to which the wealth they have produced is being put by others than the ones who played a part in its production. That brings me to two experiences which I will describe to you. The first was my response to an invitation from the president of the Ford Foundation in his offices in New York. His name, Roland Gaither. Upon arriving there, I was greeted with the following. Mr. Dodd, we invited you to come because we thought that perhaps, off the record, you would be kind enough to tell us why the Congress is interested in the operations of foundations such as ourselves. Before I could think how best to reply, he volunteered this. Mr. Dodd, we operate here under directives which emanate from the White House. Would you like to know what the substance of these directives is? My answer was, yes, Mr. Gaither, I would like very much to know. Whereupon he said, the substance of the directives under which we operate is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Needless to say, I nearly fell off the chair. As soon as I could recover myself to reply, I said, Mr. Gaither, legally you are entitled to use your grant-making power for this purpose. But I don't think you are entitled to withhold this information from the American people, to whom you are beholden for your tax exemption. So why do you not tell the American people what you have just told me? His answer was, Mr. Dodd, we would not think of doing that. That was one experience that was very informative. It was incredible. Nevertheless, it is the truth. The next experience involved the acceptance of an invitation from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This invitation came in response to a letter which I had written the endowment, asking a few pertinent questions. By pertinent, I mean that they related to the effort of the Congress to determine if foundations were engaged in what the Congress said could be un-American activities without defining un-American. I arrived at the office of Dr. Joseph Johnson, who was then president of the endowment. He was the successor to Alger Hiss. Present were two vice presidents, relatively new men, and counsel, a partner in the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. After amenities, Dr. Johnson opened the conversation this way. Mr. Dodd, we have received your letter. We can answer the questions, but it will be a great deal of trouble. The reason for its being a great deal of trouble is that with the ratification by the Senate of the United Nations Treaty, our task was done. And so we bundled up everything in the way of records and sent them to the warehouse and adopted a policy of constructing a building across the street from the United Nations, which will serve as a facility for the benefit of those many organizations which from this point on will be bound to follow the activities of the United Nations. So we have a counter-suggestion, which is as follows. If you can spare a member of your staff and send him to New York for 2 weeks, we'll provide a room in our library and also make available to him the minute books of this corporation from its inception. My first reaction was that he had lost his mind. I had some suspicion of what these minute books might well contain. But here was counsel, and there seemed to be no disagreement on the part of the vice presidents, and all of them were relatively young. So my guess was that none of them had ever read the minutes themselves. As a result, I accepted the invitation and did send a member of my staff to New York. That member brought back to me on dictaphone belts the following. We are now back to roughly 1908, when the trustees raised a question, asking themselves, is there any way known to man more effective than war, assuming they wish to alter the life of an entire people? They discussed this question academically and in a scholarly fashion for almost a year and came up with the conclusion that war is the most effective means known to man, assuming that objective. Then they raised question number 2. How do we involve the United States in a war? This was in 1909. I doubt if there was any subject more removed from the minds of the people in this country at that time than the possibility of involvement in war. There were intermittent shows, you will remember, in the Balkans. And my guess is that not many people in the country even knew where the Balkans were. They answered the question this way. We must control the diplomatic machinery of the United States. That brings up question number 3, which is, how do we secure control of the diplomatic machinery of the United States? And the answer comes up, we must control the State Department. That fits in with prior findings which we had uncovered, namely that the hand of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace inside the State Department was a fact. Finally, we are in a war. These trustees have the brashness to congratulate themselves on the wisdom and validity of their original decision, because already the impact of our participation in World War I has indicated its capacity to alter our national life. They even go so far as to word and dispatch a telegram to President Wilson, pressuring him to see to it that the war does not end too quickly. Finally, the war is over. The trustees then take up the problem which they face, namely, of preventing, as they put it, a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914. They came up with the conclusion that, to gain that end, we must control education in the United States. They realize this is a prodigious piece of work. So they seek and obtain the assistance of the Rockefeller Foundation. They then divide the task into parts, giving to the Rockefeller Foundation the responsibility of altering education as it pertains to domestic subjects. They retain for themselves the task of altering our education as it pertains to subjects bearing on our international relationships. They then decide together that the key to this is an alteration in the teaching of American history. So they approached 3 of the then existing prominent historians with the proposition that they alter the manner in which, up to then, they had presented the subject. They are all turned down flat. They then decide that it is necessary for them to build their own stable of historians. They approach the Guggenheim Foundation, which specializes in the awarding of fellowships, and suggest, when we discover a likely young person who is studying and looking forward to becoming a teacher of history, we will take him to London to pursue his studies. So they take 20 to London, and these 20 are briefed in what is expected of them. These 20 return and eventually become the most active influence in the American Historical Society. This coincides with the appearance, which perhaps you will remember, of book after book, the contents of which cast aspersion on the founders of this country, cast aspersion on the ideas which prompted the founding of this country, and relegates them to the realm of myth. Finally, toward the end of the 1920s, the endowment grants the American Historical Society $400,000 for the sole purpose of rendering a report as to what the future of this country promises to be and should be. This appears in 7 volumes. The 7th volume, of course, summarizes the contents of the other 6, and it ends on this note: the future belongs to collectivism, administered with characteristic American humanitarianism and efficiency. Well, in a sense, this was the whole story written down. And Mr. Reese, who was chairman of the investigation, the last investigation of foundations, hoped to be able to accomplish this. He was not able to do this owing to the disinterest on the part of the committee's counsel and the violent activities of one of its members. I might mention that that member whose activities barred the way was none other than Wayne Hayes, who has come to the end of his career, although this marked the start of it. End of quote. Mr. Dodd concluded his talk with some additional comments, which I want to save for another discussion, since they go beyond the subject of foundations alone. But you may want to replay what I have just recited from his speech, noting carefully how different the truth is from appearances. And remember, the truth has many enemies. And so it is that the 20th century has been an unparalleled era of increasingly destructive warfare, violence, and terror on a worldwide scale. By pursuing with relentless determination the goal of merging the United States into one world government, the trustees of the key group of major foundations have brought us to the threshold of nuclear war one, to be waged primarily on American soil. As I first revealed in monthly audio letter number 12 from May 1976, some of the present-day trustees of these foundations have been awakening to the threat of a Soviet double-cross in the grand plan for world domination. And last summer, this double-cross got underway with the planning of short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles within the territorial waters of the United States, as well as of many other countries. But the worldwide economic and political empire that is today presided over by the 4 Rockefeller brothers is so huge that it includes many individuals who still do not believe that any Soviet double-cross will take place, much less that it is already underway. For example, last month I reported that 18 Soviet submarines were deployed along our west coast, preparing to inject plutonium particles into the air on November 20, 1976. And our own EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, was cooperating by telling us that on that date, a radioactive cloud from a Chinese atomic test would begin passing over our west coast, when actually the radioactive cloud from China had not yet left China's own borders. By interesting coincidence, Russell Train, the head of the EPA, arrived in a presumably safe location, Moscow, on November 19, the day before the plutonium was to be released by the Soviet subs. With appropriate irony, he arrived there as head of the United States delegation to the Soviet-American Commission for Cooperation in Environmental Protection. Can you imagine? The plutonium was released by the subs as scheduled on November 20, but just as happened when this was done the first time in early October, unusual weather conditions kept the United States from being badly contaminated. The plutonium cloud drifted across the upper part of the United States and had little effect at ground level. But my friends, the Soviets never give up. 5 days ago, on December 13, I learned that Soviet submarines were lining up along the northwest coast of the United States for the third time for this purpose. This time, there are 21 submarines loaded with plutonium poison to inject into our atmosphere. According to my latest intelligence sources, 16 are deployed along the coast from Seattle, Washington to Eugene, Oregon, while 5 more lie between Eugene and Eureka, California. All of these are within 20 miles of the shoreline. I've already explained in detail the connection between this radioactive chemical warfare and the swine flu hoax being perpetrated by the United States government, particularly in monthly audio letter number 17. Therefore, it is significant that the so-called swine flu inoculation program was halted with great publicity 2 days ago, owing to death and paralysis suffered by many who have taken the vaccine. This serves to focus the nation's attention once again on the terrible threat swine flu is said to be, just at a time when the Soviet submarines are once again prepared to inject a poison into our atmosphere that can produce severe flu-like symptoms. It may be that, as was done the past 2 times, the Soviet submarines will wait for another announcement from the United States government that it will serve as a cover story, such as a Chinese nuclear test, before releasing the plutonium into our air. But now they have acquired some experience, and it is possible that they will release the plutonium at any time. Meanwhile, the buildup for war continues. While the mounting Soviet threat to Europe is fraying the nerves of NATO defense ministers, the most immediate threat to Europe is once again emerging in the Middle East. In my monthly audio letter number 6 over a year ago, I revealed the overall plan that existed at that time for war to begin in the Middle East. I ask you now to listen to that audio letter number 6 again. All is nearly ready once again for the long-planned war in the Middle East to be ignited. The Rockefeller oil interests now have gotten most of their money out of the Arab region, now that title to all the oil fields have been sold to the Arabs themselves. The Middle East war will also leave the United States in an even more defenseless position that we are now in, if the Soviet surprise attack on our country is allowed to take place. Last month, I explained in detail why the underwater missiles that are being planted along our shores by the Soviet Union are so crucial to them in their plan to defeat the United States in nuclear war one. But I also explained that they are no longer being removed by the United States Navy. Since I recorded that tape, 57 more nuclear missiles have been planted in our own territorial waters. Added to the 36 I mentioned last month, this brings the total to 93 Soviet missiles in the waters of the United States, including Alaska and Hawaii. In addition, 4 missiles still threaten the Panama Canal, and 5 more missiles now threaten Canada. I declared last month that I would no longer reveal the locations of these missiles unless and until responsible arrangements are made to inform the public of the deadly threat we are under. Our secret rulers had been using my information from October 1st onward only for their own benefit, and that is not what it is for. I intend to continue to hold my silence until action is taken for everyone's benefit. Nevertheless, I'm going to make one exception at this time. It involves Hawaii. World War II began with a devastating surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. And now, no less than 9 Soviet underwater missiles now threaten Pearl Harbor and the island of Oahu with the same fate a second time. I will now give the coordinates for these 9 missiles only, in hopes that this time action will be taken to protect the United States Pacific Fleet from the attack that could come at any moment. These coordinates are missile number 1, 21 degrees, 13 minutes, 47 seconds north, 157 degrees, 46 minutes, 28 seconds west. Missile number 2, 21, 18, 37 north, 157, 57, 21 west. Number 3, 21, 17, 31 north, 158, 4, 17 west. Number 4, 21, 21, 19 north, 158, 9, 7 west. Number 5, 21, 36, 12 north, 158, 12, 48 west. Number 6, 21, 36, 33 north, 158, 11, 6 west. Number 7, 21, 26, 54 north, 157, 47, 17 west. Number 8, 21, 19, 27 north, 157, 38, 36 west. And number 9, about 25 miles east of Oahu and 8 miles north of Molokai, at 21, 21, 13 north, 157, 15, 26 west. I continue to hope, my friends, that a war can still be prevented. To find out what you can do in the event war does come, I suggest you read issue 135 of McKeever's Multinational Investment and Survival Letter, 1012 Russell Street, Baltimore, Maryland, zip 21230. But my prayer is that you will never need that kind of information. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.